Tonight on The American Experience, he spoke of peace until they killed his family and took his land. Now he chose to fight. He would become the U.S. Army's most wanted renegade.
Apaches were taught, fight when you've got the strength, and it's best to die young.
Geronimo and the Apache Resistance, tonight on The American Experience.
A misty lake reflects a hazy pink sun. A logo appears, The American Experience. A montage of black and white images, mustached miners, a Native American woman, a black Union soldier. On a bridge, a steam engine charges. An immigrant mother shows her child a flag, and a Japanese boy clutches a book. We glimpse tall evergreens and a waterfall. An early wooden biplane glides a few feet off the ground, then swoops up. We soar over a rural town draped in autumn colors. Sparks fly as men on carts roll on an assembly line. Fishing boats cruise into a harbor. A crowd cheers under a welcome home sign, and a sailor squeezes his girl. A beaming couple poses for a photo. Ticker tape tumbles, children salute, and purple mountains tower over a shining city. A lush green field meets a powdery blue sky. The American Experience with David McCullough.
Major funding for this series is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the annual financial support of viewers like you.
The American Experience was made possible by generations of Americans. Funding for this program was made possible by American Express.
Now, a book-filled study.
Hello, I'm David McCullough. Our film tonight breaks new ground. I think it's also one of the most beautiful in our series. It's called Geronimo and the Apache Resistance. Who was the legendary Geronimo? Who were the Apache? Or more to the point, who were the Chiricahua Apache, and what was their story in reality? To an Apache, the past is traditionally a closed subject. To speak of the dead is taboo. So the Chiricahua have kept their experience largely to themselves, until now. What you're about to see is a privileged view. The Chiricahua have agreed to talk on camera as they never have before. For 20 years, Geronimo and his people fought to keep their land and their way of life. For 27 years, they were held prisoners of war, longer than anyone in our history. Theirs, too, is a powerful American story.
Now our view soars over a steep, rocky mountain smothered by a dense, cottony cloud. Below its craggy cliffs, a spreading olive-green plain streaked with cloud shadows.
The Apaches traveled light and left little behind them.
A photo of a dark-skinned man with broad cheekbones and chin-length hair.
But like a great wind, they left a powerful memory of their passing.
A gray mist rolls through a pine-filled valley, a black-and-white photo of a strong-jawed man with long, straight hair.
They were nomadic, hunters, gatherers, and warriors. They called themselves the people.
A wide-eyed girl leans against her mother.
One of the most celebrated Indian warriors the land has ever known was Geronimo, the legendary war shaman of the Chiricahua Apaches.
He has deeply wrinkled skin.
But Geronimo and the Chiricahuas became so entangled in myth that until the 1930s, less was known about them than any other major group of North American Indians, though they had dominated the history of an entire region for generations.
Geronimo stands with three Apache men. Each holds his own shotgun. Now, an aerial view of arid mountains lit starkly by the sun. A title appears, Geronimo and the Apache Resistance.
This is the story of a clash of cultures and of a people's love for the land. But even more important, it is the search for the reality behind the Apache myth. The myth says that there was a single Apache nation. In reality, there were many separate groups spread across the Southwest. One of these was the Chiricahua Apaches, and this is their story. The myth says that the Chiricahuas were warlike, bloodthirsty savages. In reality, they never wanted war. They fought to survive and to defend their right to the land. The myth says that Geronimo was a Chiricahua chief. In reality, he was a medicine man, the influential mentor of Naiche, the true hereditary leader of their people. This story will be told as never before by the direct descendants of those who were there.
Naichi, my grandfather, was with Geronimo all through the time, well, most of the time when the fighting was going on.
Elvis Ugar.
He was with one of the men in Geronimo's band.
My grandfather said that our people needed to survive, and these things took place.
Burl Cancia, Mescalero, New Mexico.
It wasn't only our men folk that were agile. The ladies also, some of the ladies were also trained as warriors.
My grandmother and my father had been out on the warpath with Geronimo, and my grandmother,
Rui Darrow,
said that she was tired of running and hiding and tired of being hungry.
I think they withstood things that very few others could have withstood. And we had moral standards that were really strong. And they call us savages.
Mildred Cleghorn, Apache, Oklahoma.
The Apaches would permit no challenge to their right to the land, for Apache culture was inseparable from the natural world.
The giver of life is everywhere. The very fact that you breathe the air you breathe in, you talk to the air, and it's the giver of life. The very fact that it's alive, it's God, the giver of life.
The land was beauty, harmony, and power, and everything in it was invested with life.
Two young pronghorns.
An essential link with this world were medicine men like Geronimo. He was a holy man with special access to the supernatural power in the land.
Lightning branches down to cloud-shadowed plains.
My father said he was a great medicine man. See, a medicine man blessed all the war equipment that the people used. And they didn't think that a bullet would touch them.
Alan Hauser.
In those days, everybody believed in the medicine man. That's when they say the power of the Indian religion was strong yet.
Geronimo, he had this power of the coyote.
Milford Uzos, Sr.
And the coyote, you know how he is. You could see him running around out there. Pretty soon he'd be over here, pretty soon he'd be over there. Or else he'd be on this side here. He can outfox anybody. He can outfox you, he can outfox the white people. The soldiers were coming. And yet the soldiers passed them without even seeing them, because they turned to whatever's around them, they turned to that. The soldiers don't see them, they just ride right by them. The power of these mountains is a power that you can't explain. You have to believe.
Fog drifts eerily through a wall of pines.
Right now, you can go to the Guadalupe Mountains. You can hear crown dancers. You can hear singing in these caves, and there's nobody there.
Cave paintings of human figures. One holds a sword, the other rides a horse.
This is the reason why we believe in our crown dancers in this way, to protect from evil. Can you imagine in your mind? You got a big bonfire out there.
A tribe of men wearing tall carved headdresses shaped like three-pronged pitchforks dances around a blazing bonfire. They wave sticks rhythmically as they bounce from one foot to the other. Their bodies are painted ash black, except for white designs on their arms and across their chests.
Many times the dominant society did not understand who we were. They called us raiders, they called us thieves, they called us a warring people. But we had to do some of those things in order to survive and remain a people that we are. And above all, to hold our lands as much as we could.
Burl Cancia. Now, the round dome of a church topped with a cross and a bell tower.
In the early 1800s, Apache country was part of Mexico. Mexico did not recognize the Apaches' right to the land as original inhabitants, and conflict between them was constant.
An etching of a hung Indian, his limp body stuck with arrows.
During the 1840s, the Apaches were faced with the threat of extermination, since they would surrender neither their land nor their way of life.
The skeletal remains of a crucified Indian.
In Mexico, American bounty hunters like Stephen Meek could earn $100 for the scalp of an Apache man, $50 for a woman's, and $25 for a child's.
Meek smiles behind his bushy beard.
Violence like this was a part of the Apache experience when Geronimo was growing up. And on March 5th, 1851, he himself was dealt a crushing blow by Mexican brutality. 400 Mexican soldiers attacked an undefended Apache camp, slaughtering women and children. Among the 21 dead were Geronimo's wife, mother, and children.
He was never a renegade like what people said about him until the time when he was on his way to talk about peace. And behind him, his family was slaughtered, his wife and children.
Elvis Ugar.
In his autobiography, Geronimo said, "I did not pray, I had no purpose left, and whenever I saw anything to remind me of my former happy days, my heart would ache for revenge."
Wielding a rifle, Geronimo scowls fiercely, his thin lips pressed together. Head-dressed Apache men squint into the distance.
In spite of such violence, the Apaches were never subdued by Mexico. But international events were about to complicate their lives. Apache country was part of a vast territory that the United States had just won in a war with Mexico, completing an American dream of control over the Southwest. But from the Apache point of view, the land was not Mexico's to give away. For over their own homelands, Apaches held virtually undisputed control.
Naiche has a long, slender nose and pensive brown eyes.
Since the dawn of time, the land had sustained the people. But soon there would be a new presence in Apache country, American settlers. One traveler wrote, "It was a surprise how luxuriant the grass was on this mesa, and what an inexhaustible support it affords for cattle. It was a luxury to breathe the air. Nothing more pure or more invigorating could exist upon earth."
The voice of Anita Lester, Mescalero, New Mexico.
When the white people started coming, it was kind of like just watching them to see what, you know, what would come of it. And being friends with them and trying to understand them and why they did things in certain ways.
Josephine Lahorn.
My mother's people were German people, and they were immigrants from Germany, and they came by covered wagon into this area. They were 3 or 4 years on the trip with their wagon train because they were poor people, and they worked along the way. There was mining there. And the people did a lot of prospecting, and it was surprising where they'd find gold nuggets. Most of them, I think, at that time were looking for gold, especially gold.
The voice of Anita Lester.
Eugene said that his father would go and just watch what they were doing, like building a cabin. Then they started trusting them after they found gold. Miners would come in and start digging around, moving them, shooting at them, chasing them away from their little places where they were living. He said they started getting bigger pieces of land, and then told them not to go on there and not to hunt. And they were just pushing them and pushing them. So then they started mistrusting each other, and it just went from bad to worse.
Rows of soldiers, a white man's cabin hung with pelts.
Mining and overhunting created conflict between the settlers and the Apaches. Treaties were violated by lawless elements in the white population, for whom the only good Indian was a dead Indian. Although there were some settlers who befriended them, Apaches were seen mostly as an obstacle to white exploitation of the land. By 1861, the uneasy standoff in Apache country collapsed, and war was on.
When the people were invading the area, they were coming in, the pioneers, the Mexicans, and everybody trying to come in and settle the area and know where the Apaches said that they had lived all their lives as far back as they can remember. That was their home. And if somebody come into your house there and is going to take it, nobody's going to stand for that. At least Geronimo didn't.
Alan Hauser, an etching of an Indian sniper.
This was the beginning of the Apache resistance, and the warfare to crush it tore the Southwest apart for 25 years. White hatred for Apaches deepened. Vigilante groups were formed, and by 1871, it was more dangerous for Apaches than for the settlers. William Ury, a prominent Tucson, Arizona citizen, led 100 men against a camp of Apaches suspected of raiding. It was called the Camp Grant Massacre, and more than 100 Apache women and children were slaughtered. The resulting public outrage helped force the government toward a new policy that would hopefully secure and pacify the West for whites and Indians alike.
A pretty, broad-faced Apache woman.
For some time, an idea had been gathering support in Washington for the establishment of colonies where Indians would settle. This was to be the government's guarantee that the Indians would always have a place to live. It was to become the reservation system. By 1872, there were reservations for the major groups of Apaches in Arizona on their respective homelands. The Chiricahua Apaches were one of these, and their reservation was in southeastern Arizona near Fort Bowie, which had been established a decade earlier at the beginning of the Apache Wars.
A photo of the fort melts into its current remains at the foot of a mountain.
Enemies once, the Chiricahuas and the soldiers even became friends.
A closer view of the adobe brick remains. Narcissus Gayton, Mescalero, New Mexico.
The matter of liking reservations, I guess it mostly has to do with being at peace and not being on the run.
The reservation down in the Chiricahuas, it was their homeland, I guess, their stronghold, and they were free. They had hunting and water. They were just happy in the mountains.
Two smoky gray deer graze on a forested hillside. We walk over a parched mesa dotted with cacti.
The government wanted the Chiricahuas to farm the land and agreed to provide them with equipment and food supplies. The land was not good for farming, but the Chiricahuas were willing to try raising cattle. The government wouldn't help them do that, and it even failed to deliver the promised supplies. The Chiricahuas faced starvation. Even so, they kept the peace.
Mildred Cleghorn.
If they were given the cattle and horses, they loved those two things. And if they were taught how to raise the cattle and take care of their horses and raise the feed for their livestock, I think a lot of them would have made it.
In spite of these problems, there appeared to be a chance for peace. In 4 years, the Fort Bowie records show so little military activity that it was even suggested that the sleepy fort be closed.
A soldier naps on a porch.
But by 1876, there was a disastrous new federal policy, one which would close the Chiricahuas reservation and move them to San Carlos with most of the other Apaches in Arizona. The commander at Fort Bowie warned that the Chiricahuas might go to war if their reservation were closed. The federal government thought it would be efficient to centralize control of all Apaches. They also saw it as a way of opening the Chiricahuas' land to settlement and mining.
A smoky, low-lying town in a shallow valley.
A military escort came to Fort Bowie to take the people to San Carlos. A third of them agreed to go, anxious for peace at any cost. But Geronimo refused. Betrayal had once taken his family. Now it was taking the land. Along with about 400 other Chiricahuas, he escaped to Mexico. And because he had been a spokesman for this resistant group, he gained instant notoriety.
A group of crouching, armed Chiricahuas.
And so he stood up. He stood up and said, let's keep our land.
Alan Hauser.
And he had the nerve enough to say, nobody's going to take us off of this land. We're going to stand up and fight.
The reason why we fought so hard was that...
Burl Kansia.
Without the land, we would not be a people that we are. Our belief was a part of the land. And everything that grew on it, this is how we were placed on earth. And we could not see any way around it.
Within a month, enraged Chiricahua warriors had killed 68 settlers in the area that had for 4 years been a model of peace. One Arizona newspaper said, "The kind of war needed for the Chiricahua Apaches is steady, unrelenting, hopeless, and undiscriminating, slaying men, women, and children."
The news media played these instances up a whole lot. These people that were moving into the Southwest, they felt that they needed to do away with some of these people that are standing in the way. They are savages. They don't have a way of life except to kill others.
It was clear to the army that the struggle might be a long one unless Geronimo and the dissidents could be forced to come in and settle on the reservation.
Geronimo was against the white people. The other leaders tried to calm him down, but he wouldn't listen. He was always hyped up, I guess, and he was ready to go. They saw him when he raided. He just went ahead and killed people and ran off their horses. And it was Geronimo. Pretty soon, everything was Geronimo.
Geronimo had become a wanted man. The Indian agent at San Carlos learned of his whereabouts in New Mexico, and with his Apache police force, trapped Geronimo and took him in chains to San Carlos. This was the first and only time Geronimo was ever captured. The Chiricahuas cared neither for the terrain nor the other Apaches at San Carlos. The government didn't understand what an explosive situation it had created by concentrating so many Apaches here.
Mildred Cleghorn.
They wanted all the Apaches to go to San Carlos Reservation, and they didn't. They hated that place, and they didn't want any part of it. It is dry, and it is the same way today. You just go there, and you can see why they disliked it. After they were in the mountains where there was trees and water and everything and that they were used to, and then to be taken out of that and taken to San Carlos, that was just terrible.
They lined us all up, he said. And they gave us whatever name came along. He says, this man just went down the line and said, this and this is your name, he said.
Kathleen Kansia.
So he said, that's where we got our name, Smith, he said.
Burl Kansia.
Grandfather told of many instances, and his account of being on the reservation was when he was quite young. He said it was dusty and more barren than anywhere around there. He said some of the Indian agents were not really interested in helping the people. Many times the supplies and things were far short because someone else had taken them before they ever reached the reservation.
The soldiers were rude to them. The soldiers treated them like they were...
Rui Darrow.
Animals, sort of, you know, seemed to have no more thought for them than you'd have for an undesirable kind of dog.
After 2 years at San Carlos, the government moved the Chiricahuas to the adjacent Fort Apache Reservation. It was 1878, and the war for the land appeared to be over. But there was another equally devastating war against Apache culture. It affected everything from language to religion.
An Apache woman with a weathered face looks past us.
A powerful native religious movement threatened to unite all Apaches. The army brutally suppressed it, killing an influential medicine man. Only the Sierra Madre seemed safe now. Old fears were rekindled. Geronimo and young Chief Naiche fled to Mexico, taking with them 400 of their people. General George Crook, the government then decided, was the last hope for peace. Unlike many soldiers and officials, he treated the Apaches like fellow human beings. It was a cardinal rule with him: never lie to an Indian, never break a promise. At this point, the only Apaches off the reservation were the Chiricahuas, now deep in Mexico. Crook resolved to find them in the Sierra Madre and persuade them to come back peacefully if possible. But General Crook could imagine nothing more difficult. He wrote, "It would be practically impossible with white soldiers to subdue the Chiricahuas in their own haunts. The tendency of military drill and discipline is to make the individual soldier a machine. He cannot compete with an enemy whose individuality is perfect."
Alan Hauser.
My dad says that the cavalry used to come in there and they would have practice, and they would watch them. Then the Apaches would watch them, and they would be standing out there, and they'd say, "Ready, aim, fire." And the Apaches thought it was funny, because there's no way in the world that they could hit the Apaches, you know, standing up there, ready, aim, and fire. So they always moved like a cottontail. When he runs from you, you know, he jumps like that, or a deer. So they learned to move like that. The Apaches were taught. I think that's the reason they were such good fighters, it's better to die young than to let yourself get old and have someone taking care of you. That's the thing that they used to tell the young people, that fight when you've got the strength and ready to, when your body's healthy, that's when you can fight, and it's best to die young.
Crook knew that regular soldiers would be no match for the skill and ferocity of Chiricahua Apache warriors, so he enlisted other Apaches as Army scouts. These scouts made up over three quarters of the command he now led in pursuit of Geronimo and the Chiricahuas. These Apaches served because they saw Geronimo's people as a threat to peace.
With handkerchiefs around their heads, Crook's uniformed scouts pose with rifles and determined frowns.
Crook's task must have seemed impossible, but an Apache scout called Peaches knew where to look. He led the way into the Sierra Madre, where after 40 days, they finally found the Chiricahuas. Crook promised them that he would improve conditions on the reservation. They believed him and agreed to return. But within 2 years of return, the strict regimentation of reservation life became intolerable for Geronimo, Naiche, and about 100 others. Again they escaped. Again the army pursued them. Again they agreed to a peace conference with General Crook. The rendezvous took place at Canyon de los Embudos, 15 miles south of the border. It was early in 1886, and it looked like it might be the end of the Apache Wars.
Color footage fades into a black and white photo of the camp.
Charlie Roberts, the son of Crook's aide-de-camp Captain Roberts, was brought along on this historic trip. 78 years later, he described it in a tape recording.
I was a well-grown boy of about 12 years. The latter part of March, General Crook took my father, his aide, and permitted me to accompany them. They could see Geronimo's camp about a half a mile away on a ridge on the other side of the canyon.
Crook wrote in his diary, "A 1,000 men could not have surrounded them with any possibility of capturing them. I will have to play a heavy bluff game with them. I was conscious that any incident which might excite their suspicion would result in my death."
Arrangements were made and conferences held with Geronimo during the next day or two. General Crook took no troops with him at all. The only white men in the expedition were my father and Captain Burke and a few civilian packers.
A transcript of the meeting was made. Geronimo said, "There are very few of my men left now. They have done some bad things, but I want them all rubbed out now, and let us never speak of them again." Crook said to Geronimo, "You must make up your own mind whether you will stay out on the warpath or surrender unconditionally." What's more, Crook also told him that going back to the reservation right away was out of the question. The next day, they met again. Crook wrote in his diary, had private interview with Geronimo, Naichi, Chihuahua, and a couple of others with reference to their leaving this country for the East to remain there until they change their ideas and the feeling against them here dies out. Though younger than Geronimo, Naichi was the true chief, and Geronimo always deferred to him. Together, they and the others agreed on a compromise with Crook. They would surrender, then after a couple of years of exile from the Southwest, they could return to the reservation. Geronimo said, I give myself up to you. Do with me what you please, I surrender. Once I moved about like the wind, now I surrender to you, and that is all.
The reason why Chihuahua and Loco and them surrendered, they didn't want to fight. It was useless because they felt like there were too many white people and too many Mexicans, and that eventually they'd just be all killed off. Geronimo surrendered for the same reason. He said that he didn't want the tribe to disappear.
Mildred Cleghorn.
Just after they agreed to surrender, a renegade white man panicked Geronimo by telling him he would be hanged for murder in Arizona. Geronimo had reason to be afraid. He was under indictment for murder. He and Naichi, with their small band, fled south into the Sierra Madre again. Determined to continue with his campaign, Crook went to the nearest railroad station and telegraphed his commanding officer, General Sheridan, with the news. Crook wired, during last night, Geronimo and Naichi, with 20 men and 13 women, left camp. Sheridan replied, it seems strange that Geronimo and party could have escaped without the knowledge of the scouts. The scouts, Crook said, were thoroughly loyal and would have prevented the hostiles leaving had it been possible. General Crook remained confident that his men could find Geronimo.
Crook has a bushy beard and an alert gaze.
Sheridan disagreed and ordered Crook to change his strategy. This lack of support angered the seasoned general. I believe, Crook said, the plan upon which I have conducted operations is the one most likely to prove successful in the end. It may be that I am too wedded to my own views in this matter, and as I have spent nearly 8 years of the hardest work in my life in this department, I respectfully request that I may now be relieved from its command. Now the Apaches faced a different kind of war. General Nelson A. Miles was Crook's replacement. He wrote, with our superior intelligence and modern appliances, we should be able to surpass all the advantages possessed by the savages. To try and capture the 39 Apaches, Miles put 5,000 men in the field. That was one quarter of the regular army of the day. He intended to harass the Chiricahuas into submission. The diary of Dr. Leonard Wood tells just how difficult that proved to be. He wrote, when we reached the Yaqui River country, it was found impossible to make use of the cavalry, the mountains being almost impassable. Started back to camp, reaching there about midnight, nearly breaking my neck over the side of a canyon down which my mule and I took an ugly roll.
The non-Indian had marveled at the distance the group had gone in a day. Some were horseback and some were on foot.
A rocky-banked stream choked with pebbles.
They knew that the horse soldiers were still coming. They knew the distance they were at. They would fight and disappear. They just couldn't find them.
A labyrinth of weathered rock arches and passageways.
Dr. Wood wrote, old Streeter constantly seeing signs of Indians. Corporal Scott was badly shot in the fight near the Santa Barbara Peaks. They amputated his thigh today. Alsop, no use. Afraid to go out any distance.
Burl Cancia.
Geronimo knew the lands. He knew the water holes. And he would take them from one safe place to another. Many times we could not build fire. Or that it would give us away, the smoke or the actual light. And we survived, and
many times our horses were tired, and we asked the horses to give a little more, and they did, and we survived again.
The Chiricahuas had eluded the army for 6 months, but they were tired of life on the run. Word reached Fort Apache that Geronimo might be ready to talk surrender.
A lot of the elderly people really hated him because he had caused a lot of their relatives to be killed. They said that he was causing a lot of deaths unnecessarily of very innocent...
Alan Hauser.
Children and mothers, just so that he could prove his cause, you know, to hold back the people and keep the land. And in doing that, well, he lost a lot of lives. And people actually begged him to surrender.
A Chiricahua named Keita and a relative of his named Martine were enlisted as Army scouts and given the extremely dangerous assignment of finding Geronimo in Mexico. Lieutenant Charles Gatewood, a young officer well known to Geronimo, went with them to offer terms of surrender.
The two Indian scouts that took the soldiers, the American Army, into Mexico, and they were the ones who were largely responsible for talking with Geronimo first. Those people were relatives of Geronimo and people in that band. They were all one family. They were all one. They all belonged together. And that's not likely that he, under that circumstance, would have killed them.
Rui Darrow.
Keita and Martine followed the small band to the base of a well-known stronghold high in the Taurus Mountains, 50 miles south of the border.
A sparkling, shallow stream with broad, pebbly banks.
The two scouts left Gatewood's party at the river below, hoping that they would be recognized and allowed to approach unharmed. They climbed to where the hostiles were hidden.
Burl Cancia.
My grandfather, in his account, he said he was a lookout person with binoculars. And he said at a given time, then he had seen movement way down in the bottom of the canyon. That he said he saw movement, and instantly he knew who they were. They were carrying a white flag, and they were a part of our people. They had quite a discussion about those people coming. That at a given time, they said not to let them approach.
Martin is my dad's father. The soldiers stayed behind, and just those two men went up there. Geronimo had his gun right here all the time, ready to shoot. But somehow, I guess these two men just persuade him not to shoot. That's, they came for a good cause.
Evelyn Gaines.
I don't think they necessarily talked them into surrendering, but they mostly talked them into coming out and considering it as a possibility.
Rui Darrow.
After several hours of tense discussion, Martine and Keita were able to persuade Geronimo, Naichi, and the rest to meet with Gatewood down by the river. Gatewood said they must either surrender or fight it out to the bitter end. To persuade them to surrender, he told them that their families at Fort Apache were being shipped as prisoners of war to Florida, and Rui Darrow's father was on that train.
Papa was about 16, but he was at Fort Apache, and he says they called him in, and the soldiers said, well, there's going to be a roll call. So all the Apaches came together, and he said they just put them on wagons and took them up to Holbrook. Then they piled them on the train, he said, like cattle.
With all the other Chiricahuas on their way out of the Southwest, Geronimo and the small band felt totally isolated.
A half dozen grim-faced Apaches in a light cactus thicket.
Before they surrendered,
Elvis Ugar.
They talked it over among themselves. They had they got together and had a meeting. Geronimo and Naichi and a few other people were there. And they decided that they didn't want to have any more of their people killed.
There was always running. I believe this is the reason why most of the chiefs gave themselves up on kind of the women folks and the elderlies and the kids. If they were by themselves, probably they'd be still out there with all the power they have.
Milford Yuzos, Sr.
At a place called Skeleton Canyon in southeastern Arizona, there is a pile of rocks where the band formally surrendered to General Miles. It is said that some army officers who were there piled up the rocks to mark the spot where 25 years of Apache warfare came to an end.
Our view drifts across the arid canyon valley. Tufts of coarse grass sprout from the rough beige ground.
The Chiricahuas were the last Indians of the Southwest to lay down arms in defense of their way of life. From now on, this land would exist for the Chiricahuas only in memory, for the Chiricahuas were about to face the toughest and most prolonged test of their lives.
A photo of white soldiers staring at Geronimo and Naichi.
Within a day of surrender, Geronimo and Naichi were prisoners of war at Fort Bowie, but they weren't the only ones. Keita and Martine and other Chiricahua Army scouts were taken prisoner too.
And here, these Apache scouts were actual soldiers.
Narcissus Gayton.
I always felt like they'd done them a real bad injustice. They used them to guide them and help them find the last group to surrender.
The Chiricahuas felt doubly betrayed. Not only had the loyal scouts been taken prisoner, but General Miles had overruled the terms of surrender already agreed upon by the Apaches and General Crook.
They made promises and they never kept their promises.
Mildred Cleghorn.
And treaties for our people, your word is your life.
They had thought probably when they surrendered they would eventually go back to their home in Arizona, but it never did happen. And they had not ever foreseen a life without going home.
Rui Darrow.
They were promised that they would be sent back in 2 years. That's the reason why he's, one of the reasons also that he was willing to surrender, because they promised him that they would return him in 2 years. But it turned out to be 27 years.
Geronimo and Naichi and their small group were forced onto the train that would take them to Florida and out of their homelands forever.
You got so much emotional feelings of how our people were treated, how they were herded into boxcars just like a bunch of cattle. You didn't have to be there to see it. You could just visualize it in your mind what happened.
They were herded on trains. It was crowded conditions, very unsanitary. And sometimes the rations, the food they were given, weren't really good. Sometimes some of it was spoiled.
I just visualized these poor people that didn't understand. A lot of them didn't understand the language. And to be moved from train to another train in these, what you call a cattle train, and not knowing where they're going, you know, my heart just ached for them.
Photos of grinning white men intercut with the staring faces of sitting Apaches.
The people in Arizona wanted to have them go just as far off as they could possibly send them. Politicians were influential enough to have it done. So that's as far as they could go, was St. Augustine, Florida. And that's where they sent them.
Naichi and Geronimo and other warriors went to Fort Pickens in western Florida. 400 went to Fort Marion, built to hold only 80. This fort was in St. Augustine, on Florida's Atlantic coast.
When they were in Florida, my father says it was so hot and they were all crowded inside the little fort and people were getting sick and they hadn't drank the water out of the well in there, and he said the water made them sick.
It's real muggy and it's quite an adjustment for people that lived in the Southwest. There was malaria present, a sickness that they didn't know about, and yellow fever. At one place, daily, there were people being taken out because they had died from these sicknesses. Our people still remained in the center, and we tended to our way of life, our beliefs, and we kept together, and this is how we made it through all that sickness.
A grainy photo of the prisoners squinting grimly.
My father was just a small boy. He must have been about 4 or 5 years old, somewhere around in there. When he got to St. Augustine, why, he used to tell about the waves, and they fascinated him because he said they used to sit on the wall of the fort and watch the waves come in.
A seagull lands on the frothy shoreline, now a group of teenage Chiricahuas.
The government sent all Chiricahua children over 12 years of age to a school for Indians in Carlisle, Pennsylvania.
Chiricahua boys with cut hair.
The Chiricahuas' land had been taken. Now they had to face the loss of their children.
Their parents didn't want them separated. It was very hard for them because due to the weather and the climate and all, that they developed tuberculosis. And a lot of the children didn't come home, and that was another thing that they hated. And they didn't want their children to leave them.
That was when they first cut my father's hair. When he first went, he had long hair, and he dressed us like all the other Apaches. And he had a haircut, and then they put white man clothes on him.
Rui Darrow.
He was still Indian, he was still Apache, first and foremost. But when he cut his hair, he became more adaptable. There's no going back to what was, nor living the way they used to live.
A dark chamber in the stone fortress. A heavy grated iron door slides shut over the sunlight, now catacomb-like tunnels.
It was clear the Chiricahuas were not likely to survive this confinement. After a year and a half, they were moved to Mount Vernon Barracks near Mobile, Alabama. They set up a small village there, but conditions were not much better.
The wind just barely moves. It doesn't blow across your face and cool. It just kind of is cloying like little, you know, damp fingers maybe. And that's what I feel so strongly when I go around there. I walk down there and I think, they walked on this road. And I know what it was like because I can feel it.
In the 40 years since their first contact with white Americans, the tribe had dwindled from several thousand to 388. It was 1896. After 8 years in the Deep South, they were moved again to land provided by the Comanche and Kiowa Indians at Fort Sill near Lawton, Oklahoma.
As they went to Lawton, it was in the evening, so they camped before they got to Lawton. And when it became dark, well, they could hear the coyotes and the old ladies in the tribe. They all started crying because they just felt like that they had come home. At Fort Sill, they had cattle and they worked together, and they had a reservation, a real reservation. They felt like they had a good life.
The former terror of the Southwest settled down to life as a grandfatherly figure, though the memory of the murder of his first family in Mexico never ceased to haunt him. A legend in his own time, he became a drawing card at Wild West shows. Geronimo dictated his autobiography. Naichi became a devout convert to Christianity. Even Geronimo went to church a few times. But he still used his magical powers to heal the sick and to conduct traditional ceremonials. He had always boasted that his power would protect him from death in battle, but his power was failing now and could not protect him from the case of pneumonia, to which he succumbed in 1909 at more than 80 years of age. In myth, he was an implacable savage. In reality, he was a man who had risked everything for his home and his way of life.
Geronimo's grave is a pyramid monument with a totemic eagle at the top. The moon glows in a periwinkle blue sky beyond rust-red mountains. Ruy Darrow.
I believe that he wished he had fought it out. I think Geronimo probably, toward the end of his life, wished that he'd stayed there and died there.
Most of his power...
Melford Yuzos, Sr.
He didn't hand it down to no one because they said that most of his power was dangerous. And he didn't want nobody to have it. So he just went with it, took it with him.
A graveyard at sunset.
In 1913, after 27 years of captivity, the Chiricahuas were released as prisoners of war. The government told them they must now leave the land they had come to think of as theirs. The land was annexed to the Fort Sill Army base, and the Chiricahuas were faced with a tough choice.
They had a choice to make, the Chiricahua Indians, to either remain in Oklahoma or relocate at Mescalero. 82 of them stayed in Oklahoma, 187 came to Mescalero.
They went by train to join the Mescalero Apaches on their reservation in southern New Mexico, leaving those behind who wanted to farm plots of land.
They wanted to come to Mescalero because the Mescaleros were good to them and befriended them, and they came to the Mescalero Reservation more than one time when they were on the run.
The Chiricahuas found the strength to make a new beginning. But the memory of traditional homelands that were taken from them has never died.
Chiricahua men in cowboy hats and jeans.
I realize how much they truly love their homeland in Arizona and New Mexico. And that's a real deep feeling that I didn't realize I had until in 86 when I went to Fort Bowie and stood in a place like Skeleton Canyon where the Geronimo surrendered and rode down the trail where my grandfather and my grandmother walked down the trail to Fort Bowie and were taken prisoners of war.
Mildred Cleghorn.
In September of 1986, exactly 100 years after surrender, hundreds of Chiricahuas returned to Arizona and the pile of rocks at Skeleton Canyon to honor the memory of their ancestors.
A wiry tree grows from the pile of round stones. Children explore and point.
I feel as though someone mentioned that it made a complete circle, and I think they didn't get to come here, but I represent a group that has always wanted to come back into the area, and I feel like that coming here has meant that we did get back through me. I see it for them. And all my life I've wanted to see this place and see the country where they came from. And I've read about it just like everyone else has read about it. And I've heard about it as a child. It's just something for me to be back here.
The visitors, many weeping, form a circle around Burl Cancia.
And we are a proud people. We are a progressive tribe back in Mescalero. Our people had said, we are going to survive. We're going to make it. This is how we were taught and we were told. We have the sacred mountains, the lakes. We're going to see them again. So we are direct descendants alive today. I'm very emotional because my grandfather had been with Geronimo's band, and these people are direct descendants of these very warriors.
That time was our time, and that was the time that made us who we are. That's our history. That's how we grew. That's how we were molded. They tried to adapt to Christianity as much as possible, but the old ways and the way they believed were still there, and they are still, in fact, there.
The painted Chiricahua stick dance around a bonfire.
Whereas you talk about a tradition and you think perhaps it might just be singing a song or speaking your language, but tradition is also something that you feel and something that you know, and that's what we are. And it was never gone.
Sparks fly from the fire, a rock formation at sunset, and Geronimo's deeply seamed, weathered face. This program has been described for blind and visually impaired audiences by Descriptive Video Service, WGBH, Boston. Described by Nancy Baker. Descriptions read by Rena Baskin. Funding provided by the United States Department of Education. For a complete listing of DVS programs and services, call toll-free 1-800-333-1203. Credits roll. Produced and directed by Neil Goodwin. Co-producer Lena Carr. Associate producer Margot Barnes. Sound Margot Barnes and Hob Zabarsky. Sound editor John Waite. Original music Mason Daring. Narrator Neil Goodwin. Sound mixer Richard Bach. Board of advisors Dr. Keith Basso, Dr. Barney Barnes, Mildred Cleghorn, Dr. Donald Cole, Lori Davison, Dr. Richard Ellis, Tom Naylor, Dr. Morris E. Oppler, Dan Thrapp. Copyright 1988, Peace River Films Incorporated, and WGBH Educational Foundation, all rights reserved. For the American Experience, coordinating producer Janet McFadden, executive editor Lewis Wiley Jr., senior producer Margaret Drain, executive producer Judy Crichton. A Peace River Film for the American Experience, copyright 1988, WGBH Educational Foundation, all rights reserved.
A production of WGBH Boston.
A credit appears. This program was originally funded in part by Aetna.
Major funding for this series is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the annual financial support of viewers like you.
The American Experience was made possible by generations of Americans. Funding for this program was made possible by American Express.
Video cassettes of this program can be purchased for educational use only by calling toll-free 1-800-328-PBS1. Home video sales are not available through this offer.
This is PBS.